Welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Friday, May the 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here is our first story. It's entitled UMB Financial Details Plan for HTLF Purchase. Kansas City-based company pledges $100,000 to a local fundraising effort as part of its focus on stewardship. This is written by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. As a national financial services company prepares to acquire financial institution HTLF, officials with both companies say they are focused on collaborative growth and committed to a strong Dubuque presence moving forward. UMB Financial announced earlier this week that it will acquire HTLF, the parent company of Dubuque Bank and Trust, in an all-stock deal valued at about $2 billion. The transaction is expected to be completed in the first quarter of 2025, pending regulatory approval. The deal, which arose from an unsolicited offer, is expected to be the largest in UMB's history and will lead to UMB having $64.5 billion in assets. In an interview with the Telegraph Herald on Thursday, UMB Chairman and CEO Mariner Kemper said UMB is confident its broader product set and liquidity can add value to HTLF and DB&T's already strong history in Dubuque. The thing that we see in coming together with HTLF is an ability for the combined companies to be bigger, bolder, smarter, stronger, faster, right there in Dubuque, he said. It's two companies focused on making Dubuque better and all the other communities that we're in. UMB is based in Kansas City, Missouri, and operates branches in Missouri, Illinois, Colorado, Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Arizona, and Texas. HTLF, formerly known as Heartland Financial USA, previously was based in Dubuque, but moved its headquarters to Denver, Colorado last year as part of its efforts to bring the company's 11 charters into a single location. The company's bank currently served communities in Arizona, California, Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, New Mexico, Texas, and Wisconsin. Kemper said it's highly likely that local facilities and DB&T banks will see rebranding as part of UMB's acquisition of HTLF, but stated that the only changes to the customer experience will be positive. The name on the door is a lot less important than what you do with the name, he said. I can assure you that we will move quicker, respond faster, and be more nimble and flexible than anybody else in town. After the closing of the deal, former HTLF stockholders are expected to collectively hold about 31% of the combined company. HTLF representatives will have 5 seats on a newly expanded board of UMB, though additional details remain in discussion. Although Kemper said it is still too early to say what impacts the acquisition will have in terms of eliminating or merging positions, he said there will be some impact which officials with HTLF and UMB will discuss as soon as possible. There are areas where both organizations have some of the same staff, and we'll be looking at that, he said. It all will be done with as little impact as possible and done with care and heart. HTLF President and CEO Bruce Lee said no changes currently are planned for staffing of DB&T. According to Ryan Lund, HTLF Director of Corporate Communication, HTLF and DB&T currently employ a combined total of approximately 350 people in Dubuque. We operate separately until we close, so from an employment standpoint, nothing's changing immediately because we have to operate and they have to operate, Lee said. In February, Lee announced plans to retire from his position as CEO and his spot on the company's board of directors at the end of 2024. He said Thursday that his intent, with the board's support, is to remain in his position through the closing of the acquisition in early 2025. Kemper said corporate citizenship is a key component of UMB's business model. We're all about weaving our way into the fabric of the communities where we do business because we're lucky to benefit from the resources that the communities we serve give us, he said. We're the stewards of local deposits, so we feel obligated to return the reward that all of the employees and shareholders of UMB get from being able to steward those assets. As the first step into that corporate citizenship in Dubuque, Kemper said UMB will be making a $100,000 contribution to Dubuque Community-Wise ongoing effort to construct a new facility. When contacted by the TH on Thursday, Dubuque Community-Y CEO Tony Calabrese said the organization is grateful for the donation. "We're very excited about this fantastic gift that will be a contribution to the new future YMCA," he said. "We're glad to see UMB in our community, and we're excited about the community partnership and being part of that initial piece of them coming to town." Next up is an article entitled, "Testimony Focuses on Investigation." Law enforcement and a medical examiner testify as Ramel Enoch murder trial continues. This is written by Grace Nealand of the Telegraph Herald. Local law enforcement on Thursday testified to the beginning stages of an investigation into the 2021 death of a Dubuque woman during the ongoing trial of the man accused of killing her. Ramel D. Enoch, age 24, is charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with first-degree murder in relation to the death of 20-year-old Kylie J. Duster. The trial continued Thursday with testimony from several members of local law enforcement as well as the deputy state medical examiner. Police found Duster dead in her Dubuque apartment on July 28, 2021, in the closet of her bedroom. She had not been seen or heard from since July 25, 2021, when she was spotted with Enoch at multiple locations around town, witnesses have testified. Deputy State Medical Examiner Jonathan Thompson testified Thursday to the completing an autopsy on Duster's body, and he ruled her cause of death as suffocation and her manner of death as homicide. A white cloth stuffed in Duster's throat was removed during the autopsy and identified as a T-shirt, Thompson said, and bruising was found along her face, neck, torso, and outer extremities. Suffocation typically takes several minutes, he explained, and her body showed clear signs of decomposition. Potentially, the shirt was stuffed into her mouth, and then hands were held around the jaw area in order to secure the jaw closed and keep the shirt in the mouth, Thompson said, referencing bruises found beneath Duster's jaw. Upon cross-examination, Thompson clarified that he could not ascertain the events leading up to Duster's death with complete certainty. He classified her injuries as perimortem, meaning they took place shortly before or after death without an exact timeline. "I wouldn't be able to say with 100% certainty exactly what occurred," Thompson testified. Defense attorneys have not argued that Enoch did not kill Duster, but rather contended it was done as an unplanned reaction to a not-yet-described stimulus. On Thursday, Dubuque Police Department investigator Kurt Rosenthal testified to reviewing traffic camera footage from July 25, 2021, that showed Duster driving her car around Dubuque with Enoch in the passenger seat. The pair was last seen on traffic camera footage at a gas station at approximately 9:38 p.m. July 25, 2021. Footage played for the jury showed the two arriving at the gas station, purchasing a few items, and leaving to return to Duster's home. After they leave the gas station and turn eastbound onto West 11th Street, Kylie Duster is never seen alive again, Rosenthal said. Duster's vehicle was seen shortly after, however. At 11:52 p.m. July 25, 2021, Enoch is seen on traffic camera footage driving in the area of Duster's apartment and picking up his then-girlfriend, Destiny Baston. Duster's car, later was found outside Baston's apartment where Enoch was staying at the time. Authorities previously testified that the car had been spray-painted rose gold by the time it was located. Rosenthal testified to interviewing Enoch on July 29, 2021, and asking him why he had Duster's vehicle. He said Enoch responded that Duster told him she was going out of town on Friday, July 23rd, and that he was welcome to use her vehicle. He said Enoch also told him he had not seen Duster all weekend. When asked why he had painted Duster's vehicle, Rosenthal testified that Enoch responded, "Just 'cause." "I pointed out to him that he claimed that he had the car since Friday until police took it into custody on July 28th and asked how then Duster's family had video of her in the car on Sunday afternoon, and he just shook his head," Rosenthal said. Bastin also testified Thursday, stating she had been dating Enoch since early July 2021 and that he had been living in her apartment since the relationship began. She testified that she lost contact with Enoch on July 23rd and did not see him again until the evening of July 25th. Enoch previously had crashed Bastin's vehicle, she said. When he picked her up July 25th, she said he told her the car, later identified as Duster's, was one he had found as a replacement for that vehicle. He seemed excited when he picked me up, she said. Then we just went back to the apartment. On July 28, 2021, Bastin said Enoch told her he thought they should spray paint the car because he didn't like that color. The pair then went to Walmart, where Bastin said Enoch bought the spray paint used to alter the vehicle. Rosenthal's testimony had not concluded by the end of the day Thursday, so he will return this morning for further testimony and cross-examination by Enoch's defense team. Additional witnesses are expected to testify after Rosenthal is done. Our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald today is entitled, Family Honors Memory of Boy Who Defied Odds. Cade McGovern was expected to live only a few weeks, but he went on to enjoy a life filled with adventure. This is written by Maia Bond of the Telegraph Herald. When thunder rumbles on rainy days, Chase McGovern, age 11, of Dubuque, likes to think it is his brother up in heaven herding and riding giraffes, his favorite animal. Chase's brother, Cade McGovern, was just 8 years old when he died in November from a bacterial infection. But in those 8 years, the Dubuque boy defied all odds to live a full life, his family said. The boy's mom, Erin McGovern, had multiple complications during her pregnancy with Cade, and he wasn't expected to live for more than a few hours to a few weeks after being born. We live by the philosophy of, do you want to remember him watching TV, or do you want to remember him going on vacations, said the boy's dad, Ryan McGovern. So that's what we tried to do, just go everywhere and do everything and make that possible. When Cade was born in 2015, doctors were surprised to see him breathing on his own. He spent 19 days at University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital before going home with his family. Cade was diagnosed after birth with lissencephaly, a rare condition in which the brain is smoother than it should be, which can lead to significant physical and intellectual disabilities. He also had Pierre-Robin syndrome, a birth defect identified by an underdeveloped jaw which caused him to have trouble breathing. When Cade was about 6 months old, Erin and Ryan opted for their son to undergo his first mandibular distraction, a surgery that extended his jaw 19 millimeters. Prior to that, if he laid on his back or sat straight, his tongue would block his airway and he would stop breathing, Erin said. Soon after he was born, Cade started having seizures that would continue for the rest of his life. In his first few months of life, he was in the hospital about every 3 weeks, Ryan said. Cade would become a regular at the Iowa City Hospital over the years, but even with his health challenges, Cade's family made every effort to make sure his short life was full of adventure. Erin said Cade's affinity for giraffes began during the family's Make-A-Wish Foundation trip to the San Diego Zoo. He was obsessed with giraffes ever since, Chase said. After that first visit, the family tried to visit at least one zoo every summer. In Cade's memory, the McGoverns are sponsoring a room at Ronald McDonald House Charities in Iowa City, which will be decked out in a giraffe theme. Cade also loved the water, and through his travels, he touched the Gulf of Mexico, Caribbean Sea, Atlantic Ocean, and Pacific Ocean, Ryan said. During a vacation in Galveston, Texas, he spent several hours straight in the pool. He just absolutely loved to float in the water, and you can tell he was so relaxed and so happy, Erin said. Anytime we got that opportunity, we made sure he could do it. Cade couldn't speak, but still was able to communicate with his family. Erin said he had different connections with everyone, but was particularly close with Chase. Once you got to know him, his personality really shined through, Erin said. You could tell when he was happy. You could tell when he was upset. Chase never saw Cade as different, just as his brother and his best friend. He always wanted Cade to be as involved as possible, Ryan said. If we went on vacation, he wanted Cade to come, Ryan said. If we were just going to the pool, is Cade coming? Is Cade coming to watch me play soccer? Is he coming to watch me play pickleball? they were always attached at the hip. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Chase at times wasn't allowed to visit Cade when he was hospitalized, but since Cade was such a regular patient, the hospital made few exceptions, Ryan said. Chase would come visit and jump in bed with Cade and just relax and watch movies, Ryan said. Cade's heart rate would drop, O2 levels would go back to normal. When Chase couldn't be there with Cade, the boy's parents recorded Chase reading stories so Cade could still hear his brother's voice in the hospital. Asked what Cade meant to him, Chase said, "Everything." Cade spent so much of his life around medical staff, they became like family to the McGoverns, Ryan said. The staff at both University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital and Ronald McDonald House Charities in Iowa City made life much easier during their frequent visits. Cade touched the lives of everyone he met, including those staff members, Ryan said. His wake was 6 hours long, with many nurses and medical staff from Iowa City making the drive to attend. His pallbearers included his pediatrician and a nurse from the Iowa City Children's Hospital. To show their continued appreciation for the support they received while Cade was sick, a trophy will be awarded in Cade's memory to the first finisher pushing a wheelchair or stroller during the Ronald McDonald House Charities Red Shoe Run and Walk 5K on Sunday, May the 5th in Iowa City. Along with the trophy, the recipient also will get a stuffed giraffe. The family always participated in the annual run together with Cade. Cade was always with us, but he couldn't participate in pickleball or basketball or things like that. But the run is something he could participate in, and it was a family event always, Aaron said. This is our way of keeping him in that event. His family hopes to keep his memory alive and remember him as a loving brother and son and the strongest person any of them ever met. He fought until the very end, Aaron said. He had his way of showing us that he was going to be okay. And now he comes back and makes thunder, Ryan said. Next up from the Dubuque and Tri-State page is an article entitled Optimism Rises Over Projects Linked to Dubuque County Watersheds. Progress is being made as prospects for federal funding appear bright. This is written by Benjamin Fisher of the Telegraph Herald. Dubuque County Watersheds officials say the agency is making headway on its federally funded Regional Regenerative Agricultural Practices Project, even before the program's contract is fully completed with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The county agency will make allowing farmers to stack incentives and driving growth of drone-seeded cover crops the centerpiece of its new effort and has seen encouraging interest in those planned programs. Officials also are planning to apply for the next round of federal regional conservationism partnership program funding with hopes to help the Little Maquoketa River Greenway vision be realized. Dubuque County Watersheds Coordinator Eric Schmeckel said there is still more work to do before the county receives an expected more than $4 million from the Regional Conservation Partnership Program award it secured alongside the state of Illinois and Wisconsin and Sand County Foundation. However, he recently told the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors that the RCPP program's rollout already is underway. We are still waiting on the USDA agreement with the Sand County Foundation and then a separate agreement with the Sand County Foundation and Dubuque County that will lay out the action items, objectives, and goals as stated in the grant and the dollars that the county had contributed over the next 5 years. The supplemental agreement between USDA and Sand County is due at the end of May. Right now, we're hopeful that we have a start day of July 1, he said. But the farmer-to-farmer group commissioners have come together and talked about the intent, the goals, and practices and programs we would like to see utilized in Dubuque County in the next 5 years, and some of how the $4 million to $5 million will be paid to Dubuque County farmers. We've had a lot of good input that boiled down to two projects. Those two projects include one paid for by federal funds to seed cover crops with aerial drones in response to increasingly wet autumns as the climate changes. Dubuque County Watersheds already accepted applications for that program. We have over 9,300 acres signed up for that in Dubuque County now and have a wait list of 7 or 8 landowners for that too, he said. We don't want to overcommit past what we're confident we can get done. We want to deliver a good product for farmers and not overextend ourselves. We could run into a time problem if we can't buy seed until July. We need to have the seed ordered, ideally, by the early part of June. To address that issue, Schmeckel proposed, and supervisors agreed, to use some of the watershed's remaining $250,000 for previous regenerative practice incentives to buy seed, which could qualify for the county's match for the federal funds. Supervisor Harley Potthoff expressed being impressed by the drone project's progress. "I've heard good things about the cover crop drone seeding," he said. "I wasn't aware that the grant was paying for the seed also, so I was surprised." Schmeckel said the coming months would bring even more RCPP news. The second program that will come out later this year will be more of modeling the stacking of practices with a focus on prairie strips and stream buffers, he said. Schmeckel already is planning to apply for another round of RCPP funds for 2025, up to $25 million for the long-planned Lower Little Maquoketa River Greenway plan, amended to focus on property easements rather than county land buyouts along the river. And next, Loris grad pursues passion for justice, awaits stint with Jesuit Volunteer Corps. Ava Bradley doesn't shy away from hard projects. This is written by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. Ava Bradley has long had a keen desire to address what she perceives as unfair circumstances in the world around her. "I feel like I have a very justice-centered mind," the Loris College student said. "If I see something out there that's unjust or people being taken advantage of and treated wrongly, I've always felt the need to correct that wrong or just walk with someone to help them on their own journey." Bradley, age 22, will graduate from Loris this weekend with majors in English, literature, and politics, along with a minor in peace and justice studies. She plans to channel her passion for justice and social services through a year spent with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps before attending law school. Bradley, a first-generation college student, graduated from Dubuque Senior High School in 2020. At senior, she was involved in leadership organizations such as Student Council, a trend she continued upon enrolling at Loris. Since her freshman year, she has been active in Loris's student government, including serving as student body president for the past 2 years. She also was a leader for new student orientation and spent a year as the first year experience coordinator, helping to plan and run the orientation. Kim Walsh, Assistant Vice President for Student Development and Associate Dean of Students at Loris, worked closely with Bradley in those leadership capacities. She described Bradley as a mature, strong leader who works well with others and cares passionately about both her academic work and extracurriculars. "Ava doesn't shy away from hard projects or things that are challenging. She faces them right on and works her way through it and, in the end, makes things better," Walsh said. "I've always been impressed with her ability to have challenging conversations with students but also recognize their achievements." Bradley said her ability to engage with others was strengthened in part by the critical thinking skills she developed at Loris. "There's multiple perspectives on each issue, and you have to look at them all to get a clear picture of what's truly happening," she said. Bradley will spend the next year serving with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps as a legal assistant for Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles. The organization provides training and support to formerly gang-involved and previously incarcerated people. In her role, Bradley will assist with family law and immigration cases. She hopes the experience will be a stepping stone for her future goal to attend law school and one day work in labor and unemployment law. "I'm looking forward to being able to talk to people who have had really different life experiences from me, and I hope that I'm able to learn from them, because one of the powers of a lawyer is to share others' stories," she said. Now three short stories from the News in Brief heading. First, public meeting on proposed Black Hills rate increases set. A meeting this summer in Dubuque will provide Black Hills Energy customers an opportunity to comment on proposed rate increases. The meeting will take place at 5 p.m. on August the 5th at Carnegie Stout Public Library, 360 West 11th Street, according to the Iowa Utilities Board. A press release states that the meeting will also will allow Black Hills customers to express their views on the overall quality of the utility's service. A virtual meeting will take place at 11:30 a.m. August 6th. Details about participating online will be available at iub.iowa.gov. All comments provided at the meetings or submitted in writing will become part of the permanent record, according to the release. A Black Hills press release states that the company has submitted a regulatory rate review proposal to recover investments made in safety, reliability, and system resilience. The proposal would increase the average residential customer's bill by $7.56 per month, though the exact increase would vary depending on factors such as rate class and total usage. The release states that the Iowa law allows Black Hills to implement a temporary rate increase until the Iowa Utility Board completes its review. The company plans to implement such an increase of about $2.94 per month based on average residential customer usage. The temporary increase is subject to refund after Utility Board issues its final decision. Next, man sentenced to 28 years in child pornography case. A Dubuque man has been sentenced to 28 years in federal prison for manipulating minors into sending him child pornography. Alex McClanahan, age 21, recently received the sentence in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, after previously pleading guilty to one count of sexual exploitation of children, according to a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. U.S. District Court Chief Judge C.J. Williams sentenced McClanahan to 336 months in prison with 5 years of supervised release to follow. There's no parole in the federal system. The release states that McClanahan, in 2022, used social media to conduct sexually explicit conversations with two girls under the age of 16. He admitted to persuading one of the girls to send him sexually explicit media. When law enforcement officers seized McClanahan's phone in November 2022, they found dozens of sexually explicit photos and videos of the other girl, the release states. Investigators found about 700 videos containing child pornography on McClanahan's phone in total, the release states. And Dubuque project receives $6.7 million in tax credits. A project to renovate a former Dubuque manufacturing building into apartments and commercial space has received more than $6 million in state tax credits. Fairley and Lester LLC was awarded $6,731,055 in tax credits through Iowa Economic Development Authority's Historic Preservation Tax Credit Program, according to a press release. As part of the project announced last year, Fairley and Lester LLC plans to turn the building at 801 Jackson Street into 127 market-rate apartments and to renovate a neighboring property at the corner of White and East 9th Streets to house commercial and residential space. The award was part of over $19 million in IEDA Historic Preservation Tax Credit awards that will help enhance 12 historic buildings across the state. The Historic Preservation Tax Credit program provides a state income tax credit to projects that rehabilitate underused or vacant historic buildings while maintaining their historic features. Work completed on the buildings must meet the Federal Secretary of Interior standards. Now we turn to the opinion page, and we've got an Our View. It's entitled, Caring Volunteers Swarm Dubuque. If you happened to be downtown Dubuque last Friday, no doubt you saw some people clad in green t-shirts hard at work on various projects, even in the rain. A little rainstorm couldn't stop the robust turnout for Dubuque Days of Caring, where a record 1,500 volunteers signed up to complete dozens of projects around Dubuque. Teams worked on more than 70 projects, helping out 40 nonprofits. Many volunteers came from area employers who signed up to serve with coworkers. Family and student groups also participated, as did some other individuals. The event aims to bring volunteers together to complete projects that nonprofits usually would not be able to complete alone, such as landscaping, gardening, painting, staining, organizing, and deep cleaning. Dubuque Days of Caring is a collaborative effort between Young Professionals of Dubuque, Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque, Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce, and Volunteer DBQ. Work ranged from yard work to painting, organizing to cleaning tasks. Nonprofits and others who benefited from the work appreciated all the helping hands lent to make a difference in the community. Cheers to all the volunteers who stepped up and the employers who encouraged them. Days of Caring shows a special side of the Dubuque community. If you didn't see any films last week, you weren't trying very hard. Downtown Dubuque was abuzz for 5 days with Julian and Dubuque International Film Festival. Dozens of films were shown in several locations in between parties, panel discussions, awards, and other events. Once again, our Little River City was visited by filmmakers, producers, directors, and distributors who got a glimpse of what a vibrant arts community can look like in small-town America. With growing audiences and an impressive lineup of films, Julian Dubuque International Film Festival's reputation is growing. Filmgoers got a chance to see feature, short, and documentary films on a vast array of subject matter, directed by filmmakers from all corners of the world, and even students from our neck of the woods. You don't have to be a film buff to appreciate what the festival brings to the community, because it's more than just movies. Once again, Dubuque put its best foot forward and showed itself as a great place to visit. The film festival adds another facet to local tourism. That's one of several reasons TH Media was once again involved with the film festival, this time as title sponsor. Whether visiting from one of the coasts or driving downtown from Asbury, this was a good weekend to be a tourist in Dubuque and take advantage of this unique event. If you missed out, make a note that next year's festival will be held April 23rd through 27th, 2025. The Iowa Healthiest State Initiative will mark Mental Health Awareness Month in May with new resources and engaging events to empower Iowans in spreading awareness of mental health. This annual occasion serves as a platform to underscore the significance of mental well-being and advocate for a small enhanced when advocate for enhanced access to mental health resources and services across the state. All Mental Health Awareness Month efforts by Iowa Healthiest State Initiative are a part of the organization's Make It Okay program, which works to raise awareness and reduce stigma around mental illness in Iowa throughout the year. 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience mental illness, and many suffer in silence due to stigma. Mental Health Awareness Month is an opportunity to break the silence and encourage individuals to seek help and support. Throughout the month, Healthiest State Initiative will engage in activities and events to raise awareness of mental health, including the launch of the annual Make It Okay Mental Health Awareness Month Toolkit for workplaces and individuals, Wear Green Day on May 16th, where Iowans are invited to wear their favorite green clothes and share a picture on social media with hashtag MakeItOkayIowa to raise awareness for mental health, sharing mental health resources and information on their website and social media platforms. Iowans are invited to participate alongside Iowa Healthiest State Initiative in accessing mental health resources to amplify the message through social media and in their workplaces, schools, communities, and beyond. It's time to work together to break the silence and foster a community that champions mental well-being. For more information on Make It Okay and Mental Health Awareness Month activities and events, visit iowahealthieststate.com. Now, a reminder that you are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments or concerns with this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we turn to today's obituaries, and we'll begin with Richard Rick Paul Shanahan, age 62, of Dallas, Texas, and formerly of Maquoketa, Iowa, who passed away on April the 11th, 2024, after a 2-year struggle with cancer. Rick personified courage and strength by facing each hurdle with optimism and his trademark smile. Despite the challenges of cancer, Rick remained committed to living his life to the fullest and inspired those around him to do the same. To honor Rick's life and memory, a memorial mass will take place at 11 a.m. on Saturday, May the 11th, 2024, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Maquoketa, followed by a luncheon and reflection on his life at the Eagles Club in Maquoketa. A celebration of life service will be held at White Rock United Methodist Church in Dallas at 10 a.m. on June 22nd. Rick was born on February 15, 1962, to Paul and Arlene Shanahan in Maquoketa. After graduating from Maquoketa High School in 1980, he attended Blackhawk Community College in Waterloo. Following graduation from Blackhawk, he lived in Des Moines and La Crosse, Wisconsin, before settling in Texas. While in Texas, he relocated several times to open new Target stores before finally making Dallas his permanent home. Over the past decade, Rick established a thriving real estate business as the owner of Keller Williams' Rick Shanahan team. His strong work ethic and love for the job resulted in hundreds of people finding or selling their homes. His clients and coworkers often became good friends who feel the loss of his passing. Rick was a remarkable person who touched many lives. His legacy of compassion, sincerity, and generosity will be cherished by those who knew him. Rick will also be remembered for the love and adoration of his nieces and nephews, as well as for the dedication to his passions, some of which include a fascination with trees and nature, a love of maps and travel, and an obsession with the desert and his beloved cacti. While Rick may no longer be with us, his memory will continue to inspire us to live our lives with purpose, kindness, and love. For additional information about memorial services, Rick's life, and donations in lieu of flowers, visit www.rickshanahan.com. Next, we remember Colleen A. Stockel, age 78, of Janesville, Wisconsin, who passed away on Saturday, April 27th at Mercy Hospital in Janesville. She was born in Hazel Green, Wisconsin on April 12th, 1946, the daughter of Bernard and Liddell Stockel. She was a 1964 graduate of Southwestern High School in Hazel Green, Wisconsin. She also attended Southwest Tech for retail sales. Colleen was a devoted mother and grandmother. She enjoyed spending time outside, whether it was tending to her garden or going for walks with her dogs. She also loved reading, driving around, listening to rain and storms, and most especially, she loved spending time with her grandchildren. A private family service will be held. Schneider Funeral Home and Crematory of Janesville, Wisconsin is assisting her family. For online condolences and guest book, please visit www.schneiderfuneraldirectors.com. And we remember Martha J. Zimmerman, age 95, of Cascade, Iowa, who completed her earthly journey on May the 1st, 2024, at Shady Rest Care Center in Cascade. To honor Martha's life, a celebration of life is being scheduled for a later date. Burial will be in the Asbury Cemetery in Asbury, Iowa. Next, we remember Mary K. Lonsbach, age 89, of Dubuque, who died on Wednesday, May the 1st, 2024. A prayer service will be held at 3 p.m., followed by visitation until 7 p.m., Monday, May the 6th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. A mass of Christian burial will take place at 11 a.m., Tuesday, May the 7th, at Resurrection Catholic Church. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Key West. And finally, we remember Leora C. Bemboom, age 93, of Dubuque and formerly of East Dubuque, Illinois, who died on Wednesday, May the 1st, 2024. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, May the 6th, at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. A mass of Christian burial will take place at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday, May the 7th, at Resurrection Catholic Church. Now here's a few short stories from the area news in brief. First, authorities say Platteville woman arrested on charge of third OWI. The dateline is Smelzer Township, Wisconsin. Authorities said a Grant County woman has been arrested on a charge of third offense operating while intoxicated. Shannon Bell, age 39, of Platteville, also was charged with two counts of disorderly conduct and obstruction, according to the Grant County Sheriff's Department. A press release states that authorities were notified about 2:35 p.m. Monday of a crash on Airport Road in Smelzer Township near Platteville. Authorities said Bell was traveling east on Airport Road when she crashed into a tree. Authorities responded, and it was determined Bell was intoxicated, the release states. She was taken to Southwest Health for a blood draw and then to Grant County Jail. Next, agency receives $47,000 state grant for STEAM education. This is Dateline Fenimore, Wisconsin. A Southwest Wisconsin education agency has received a state grant to support science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics teaching. Cooperative Educational Service Agency 3, based in Fenimore, received $47,396 through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corp's Fab Lab grant program, according to a press release. The program supports the purchase of equipment for fabrication laboratories, or Fab Labs, which are workshops featuring manufacturing equipment such as 3D printers, laser engravers, computer numerical control routers, and plasma cutters. The release states that since the program's inception in 2016, WEDC has awarded 211 Fab Lab grants, totaling more than $5 million to 125 school districts across the state. Cooperative Educational Service Agency 3 is one of 12 such agencies across the state and provides services to more than 30 districts in Southwest Wisconsin. The grant received by CESA 3 is part of more than $493,000 in such funding awarded to 18 Wisconsin school districts and consortiums this week. And from Dyersville, Iowa, Dyersville Library to hold spring plant sale Saturday. Dyersville's library will hold a fundraising spring plant sale this weekend. The event will be held from 8 to 10 a.m. Saturday, May the 4th, in the parking lot at James Kennedy Public Library, 320 First Avenue East. Plants donated by members of the library's fundraising committee and other community members will be available for purchase. All proceeds will be used to support the library's collections and services. Call the library at area code 563-875-8912 to make arrangements to donate plants. Now it's time to turn to the sports page, and here's what's on television today. In golf, you got the PGA Tour Champions Insperity Invitational at 11:30 a.m. on the Golf Channel. And at 3 p.m. on the Golf Channel, you've got the PGA Tour, the CJ Cup, Byron Nelson. Horse racing, Kentucky Derby at noon on USA. Major League Baseball, we got the Brewers at the Cubs at 1:10 p.m. on Marquee Sports Network, and it's also on the Bally Sports Wisconsin channel. And at 7:15 p.m., you've got the White Sox at the Cardinals on the NBC Sports Channel Chicago or the Bally Sports Midwest channel. NBA basketball, Cavaliers at Magic at 6 p.m. on ESPN, and Clippers at Mavericks at 8:30 p.m. on ESPN. NHL hockey, it's Dallas at Vegas. The time channel are to be determined. And you got the Canucks at the Predators at 6 p.m. on TNT, and the Oilers at the Kings at 9 p.m. on TNT. Top story on the front page of the sports, Saints sweep Jacks. Dubuque will play Fargo or Sioux City for Clark Cup. It's written by Jim Leitner. They've been talking about these types of moments since arriving together in Dubuque from points all over the globe on September 1st. The Dubuque Fighting Saints advanced to the United States Hockey League's Clark Cup Final for the first time since 2015-2016 with a 4-0 victory Thursday night at Muskegon. Dubuque will face either Sioux City or Fargo in the best-of-five final beginning next week. After hanging on to win the first two games in the Eastern Conference Final, Dubuque completed a three-game sweep in dominating fashion, outshooting the Lumberjacks 35-21. Kevin Riedler posted his third shutout of the playoffs, and the celebrated fourth line contributed a pair of goals. "We've been talking about getting here since day one, and it's extremely gratifying to accomplish it," second-year head coach Kirk McDonald said. "Obviously, it's easy to talk about this kind of stuff, but to put in the work over 6, 7, 8 months is a real credit to the group. We've battled adversity at different times of the year, but we found a way to come out on the other side. It's a credit to the group, and every single guy in the locker room has contributed to us getting to this point. Riedler earned his sixth consecutive playoff win after losing Game 1 of the conference semifinals. He leads the postseason in wins, goals against average at 1.23, save percentage at .951, and with his three shutouts, which accounts for half of the league's playoff clean sheets. "It's amazing. It's kind of hard to describe," Riedler said. "We've worked so hard for this. We're going to celebrate for a day or two and get right back to work for the next round." Riedler rebounded after allowing three goals in each of the first two games of the series. "I didn't worry about it," he said. "The previous games, I had some unlucky bounces. Nothing to worry about. We got the wins, and that's all that matters. I just wanted to continue riding the wave and continue having fun. I didn't want to fix something that wasn't broken. I just had to trust my game and have fun." The lone scare came with 5 minutes and 4 seconds remaining in regulation after Riedler mishandled the puck and had to scramble to get back into his crease to stop Sasha Boivert with an acrobatic save. By that time, the game had been pretty much decided by Dubuque's effort, a cause for concern in the first two games. The guys realized the effort from the first two games, from a complete game standpoint, wasn't good enough, McDonald said. "They're not stupid, but you saw it in practice Wednesday. It was the best practice we've had in a long time. They were dialed in and buzzing. You could feel it all day. They were ready." Lucas St. Louis benefited from a little puck luck to stake the Saints to a 1-0 lead at 7:56 of the second period. Dubuque received its third power play when Muskegon captain Cody Kroll took a neutral zone cross-checking penalty on Saints captain Jake Sondrial. Uri Pekarich moved the puck from the left wing to Juna Vaisen at the top of the formation on the power play. Vaisen dished it to St. Louis in the right faceoff circle, and the defenseman looked to pass to James Reeder at the net front. Reeder tangled with defenseman Jake Toll, who fell, and the shot along the ice bounced off Toll before crossing the goal line behind goalie Gadzevic. St. Louis was credited with his third goal of the postseason and second on the power play. "They had a guy in my shooting lane, so I just wanted to get the puck to Reeder, but it went in off their defenseman," St. Louis said. "Sometimes you just that one good bounce to get your momentum going, and we pretty much took control after that. It was huge to get that first goal and put even more pressure on them." Dubuque's celebrated fourth line doubled the lead at the 12-minute, 9-second mark. Teddy Merrill moved the puck through the neutral zone before Colin Frank settled a bouncing puck to create a 2-on-1 with Josh Giuliani on the right wing. Giuliani carried into the zone and snuck a shot between the legs of Gadzic for his first playoff goal. The fourth line struck again at 8:09 of the third when Giuliani scored his second goal of the night. Merrill won a battle along the left wing and poked the puck to the corner for Frank, who returned the pass. Merrill centered for a charging Giuliani, who poked the rebound of his own shot off Gadzic's right leg pad and crossed the goal line for his second goal of the playoffs. "It's just awesome to help the team out in that way," Giuliani said. "To extend the lead like we did, there's no better feeling. They were just a couple of hard-working goals. I just tried to go to the net. The puck came to me, and I put them in. But we're not done here. We still have 3 more games to win. We'll celebrate this for a little bit, then get ready for the next opportunity." The Saints, who built big leads in the first two games but had to hang on to win both, kept the pressure on Muskegon the rest of the way. Gavin Cornforth made it 4-0 with his second playoff goal just 2:25 later. Charlie Arend won a faceoff in the left circle, and Cornforth snapped a shot through traffic and past the goalie. "It's nice to get a goal, for sure, but you have to give Charlie a lot of credit. He won a lot of big faceoffs for us tonight," Cornforth said. "Coach has been on us about once we get the lead, the bench needs to get loud, and we have to keep our foot on the gas. Our leaders definitely impacted that tonight. When we saw our leaders get going, all the boys followed them. It's a huge win, and I'm sure it will fire up the boys for the next round. Dubuque enjoyed a 15-3 advantage on shots during the first period, but couldn't convert power plays after Muskegon's Matvei Gridin tripped Juna Vason and Justin Sullivy dumped Juraj Pecharik. Michael Barron and Gavin Cornforth had the Saints' best chances of the period, but the goalie denied both after they got the Lumberjacks' defense. Kevin Riedler faced two grade-A chances but denied Justin Sullivy early in the period and Danny Clares midway through the frame. Muskegon received its first power play in the final minutes of the period and didn't convert. Second-seeded Sioux City leads Anderson Cup regular season champion 2-1 in the Western Conference final. The Musketeers scored three second-period goals Thursday night en route to a 5-2 victory. Fargo won the series opener 3-1 on Sunday night, but the Musketeers earned a split with a 4-1 win Monday. Game 4 is scheduled for 7:05 tonight in Sioux City. Next in the American Legion Baseball, Minutemen seek shot at redemption. This is written by Jim Leitner of the Telegraph Herald. The Dubuque County Minutemen will have a chance to settle an old score this weekend at the American Legion State Baseball Tournament. Dubuque County will play in a three-team pod with Carroll and Mobile on Saturday in Coon Rapids, while Cedar Rapids Prairie, Great Lakes, and host Council Bluffs play in the other pod. The winners will meet Sunday in Council Bluffs for the right to advance to regional play in August. A year ago, the Minutemen dropped a 6-4 decision to Mobile to fall one game short of the state championship game. I'm really looking forward to the challenge this weekend, said Dyersville Beckman Catholic All-State outfielder Luke Sigworth, one of eight players back from last year's team. The goal is to win every game, and I believe we have the guys to do it. Our team is pretty fast, 1-9, and taking the extra bag gets us that much closer to another run. And our pitching staff is a big plus because we have a lot of great arms. Whoever we put on the mound, we can trust them to win games. Our chances are pretty high. We've built a lot of chemistry already, and that's a lot of fun playing with these guys. Mobile has established itself as a traditionally strong Legion program in recent seasons. They're real similar to what we do, Minutemen coach Ronnie Kramer said. They draw kids from about eight schools in the Sioux City area, which is always really good when it comes to baseball, so we'll have our hands full with them. The pod begins with Mobile versus Carroll at 10 a.m., followed by Dubuque County versus Carroll at noon, and Dubuque County versus Mobile at 2 p.m. The Minutemen loaded up on pitchers when selecting players from the eight high schools in Dubuque County. That's a must in the early portion of the spring schedule when Kramer's staff limits pitchers to 30 or so pitches per outing. We should be pretty well loaded with arms, Kramer said, but you really need that if you're going to win three games in 2 days with the pitch count limitations the Legion has. By now, a lot of our guys are feeling comfortable at about 75 or 80, which is a big deal. But we're not going to overuse a kid at this time of year with their high school seasons right around the corner. The nice thing is these kids just started high school practice this week. So they're getting their swings and throws in, so they should be good to go this weekend. The Minutemen take a 7-1-1 record into the state tournament after sweeping the area tournament 2 weekends ago in Dyersville. They routed Hiawatha 10-0 in 5 innings before holding off Linmar 6-3. Dubuque County's returnees also include Dubuque Wallert senior utility man Alex Kerman, Dubuque senior left-handed senior pitcher Will Sullivan, Dubuque Hempstead senior utility man Gage Bishop, as well as All-Stater Jake Goodman and Colin McDermott, who helped Western Dubuque to the past two Iowa Class 3A state high school championships. Two college players, Beckman grad and Lakeland College freshman outfielder Luke Scheitzel, as well as senior grad and co-college freshman infielder John Willey, will rejoin the Minutemen if they advance to the regional level this summer. Western Dubuque will also be represented by junior Tanner Anderson, sophomore All-Stater Brett Harris, and senior outfielder Hunter Quagliano. Seniors Will Piero and Bodie Nadelmaker and junior Will Specht will also represent Wallert. Dubuque County's roster includes Beckman senior Matthew Florence, Cascade senior Will Hosch, senior 12th grader Sam Weber, and Hempstead senior Grant Golly. The Minutemen represent the Legion posts of Cascade, Dyersville, Dubuque, Epworth, and Fairley. In the local and area roundup, Hornets rallied to beat Warhawks. Scales Mound / River Ridge saved the best for last. Trailing by 2, Scales Mound / River Ridge plated 3 runs in the top of the 7th to storm back and defeat Warren / Stockton 5-4 on Thursday in Warren, Illinois. Amy Richardson went 3-for-4 with a run scored, and Sarah Winter added 2 hits with an RBI and scored a run to lead the co-op offensively. Lakin Haas struck out 9 and allowed just 2 earned runs over 7 innings, earning the win in the circle. In boys baseball, Warren Stockton 8, River Ridge Scales Mound 3. Caden Durr went 2-for-4. George Winter, Ben Richmond, and Evan Cogan drove in runs, but River Ridge Scale Mound fell to Warren Stockton. In boys soccer, Iowa City Regina 4, Cascade 2. The Class 1A number 2 ranked Regals scored 3 goals in the second half to pull away from the Cougars. Postville 3, Western Dubuque 2. The Bobcats scored twice in the second half to close the gap, but their comeback effort fell short in a loss to Postville. And in college baseball, Buena Vista 12, Dubuque 2 in 7 innings at Storm Lake. Colin Husko scored a run and drove in another. Jake Sedeker added an RBI, but the Beavers beat the Spartans via the mercy rule. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.